Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Understanding DeFi, the Roles, Tools, Risks, and Rewards of Decentralized Finance by Alexandra Damsker. Narrated by Siri Scott. Publisher's note. This audiobook has bonus material. Please contact whomever you purchased this audiobook from to request the material. All figures and tables referenced in this audiobook can be found in the bonus material. Disclaimer. The views expressed in this work are those of the author and do not represent the publisher's views. While the publisher and the author have used good faith efforts to ensure that the information and instructions in this work are accurate, the publisher and the author disclaim all responsibility for errors or omissions, including, without limitation, responsibility for damages resulting from the use of or reliance on this work. Use of the information and instructions contained in this work is at your own risk. If any code samples or other technology this work contains or describes is subject to open source licenses or the intellectual property rights of others, it is your responsibility to ensure that your use thereof complies with such licenses and/or rights. Preface. Decentralized finance, or DeFi, is just about finance without banks. It's one of the core use cases for blockchain, which is really an innovation in accounting. DeFi will eventually be a key part of finance for people, and one of the primary ways people earn returns on their assets, whether fiat or cryptocurrency. Banks need competitors, and so do DeFi protocols. Together, they will allow people to get the highest and best returns on their assets for the lowest cost and risk. This book is not about promoting specific DeFi protocols or even about promoting the current state of DeFi. It is about understanding the entirety of the space, where it fits into blockchain, its core elements, how to operate in the space, and the future of DeFi. People who enter blockchain, and even those who have been in it for years, tend to have a sort of Swiss cheese knowledge, very deep and detailed in some areas, but almost non-existent in others. Accordingly, this book has significant background information, explaining the history and technology of blockchain and the key concepts of finance. This is to ensure that listeners have a more complete understanding of how these fields merge in the DeFi industry and what the potential and limitations truly are. How is this book organized? This book starts by laying down the foundation for the listener to understand the basic principles and history of both blockchain and DeFi. It moves from there to the tools of DeFi and how to build in DeFi. It then covers the current state of DeFi and how protocol users make money on various types of protocols. Finally, it concludes with an examination of the future of DeFi and potential areas of growth and benefit. Who is this book for, and what will you learn? This book is for anyone, whether from a business or technical background, who needs a grounding in the blockchain and DeFi space and wants to build compliantly and productively. It is also for anyone who wants to learn how to operate protocols or invest money in the DeFi space. Finally, it is for anyone who wants a great explanation of how things work in blockchain and/or finance without getting bogged down in acronyms and jargon. You don't need to have any prior knowledge to use this book. This book is not intended to be a detailed, language-specific, step-by-step analysis and implementation guide for building DeFi protocols for a specific set of requirements. After listening to this book, you should have the understanding and knowledge to help design, build, and operate successfully within the DeFi arena, however it progresses. After listening to this book, you should also have ideas of what works in DeFi and what doesn't, where risks lie, and where you are comfortable operating and even innovating. Users need to know what questions to ask developers when considering new protocols, and many need the knowledge contained in this book to understand what to ask, or if the protocols even make sense, or are just failures that haven't operated long enough to fail. Tutorials are great for working through specific needs, but a fundamental understanding of these core concepts is needed to allow teams to build correctly and compliantly, two things sorely missing in the current and already failed protocols in DeFi. We have a webpage for this book where we list errata, examples, and any additional information. You can access this page at oreil.ly/understanding_DeFi. Chapter 1. Introduction to DeFi. DeFi is shorthand for decentralized finance. That's generally what you hear when you ask about DeFi, as if that clears up all the confusion. But for most people, that definitely doesn't do a thing to clarify what DeFi is, what it does, and why anyone would want to use or build a DeFi application. So let's fix that. After all, the most important characteristic about any decision is that it's an informed one. And you can't make an informed decision in DeFi unless you know what you're working with. DeFi runs on blockchain platforms or decentralized applications called dApps. Understanding the basics of blockchain is the core of understanding how DeFi works and why. So we're going to cover that first, so you can follow along with the specifics of DeFi. After all, it would be pretty hard to explain the benefits of a Bryant pivot versus an Iverson step back if you have no working knowledge of the rules of basketball. You need to understand the boundaries of the game before you take on the advanced plays, so we have to help you understand what blockchain is and how it works before we get into one type of blockchain application. In this chapter, you'll learn what blockchain is and how it evolved, what decentralization is, what traditional finance and decentralized finance are, and the differences between them. Warning. General warning to listeners. For those listening to this and thinking they don't need a lawyer or a CPA or any other paid advisors, 1. This book is to give you a strong general grounding in DeFi and the issues surrounding the field. 2. This book isn't your lawyer. Your lawyer is your lawyer. 3. This isn't a book designed to detail these regulations for specific situations, so your particular issue is likely not covered in depth. 4. I strongly encourage everyone developing, investing in, contributing to, or using applications in DeFi to find an attorney who specializes in this area to determine whether they are subject to Know Your Customer, KYC, Anti-Money Laundering, AML, or other regulations. 5. Listen to 1 to 4 again. What is blockchain, anyway? Has anyone ever lied to you before? Has someone ever promised you they would do something and then not done it? Most of us have had some experience being on the receiving end of a lie, from the tooth fairy to a ghosted Tinder date. People promise to pay for drinks as soon as I get my check, and then disappear off the face of the earth, or pretend there was no obligation to pay, or they didn't even get the drinks in the first place. Checks get bounced, accounts get overdrawn, families invest in companies and stop speaking when they fail. People lie. But unfortunately, they aren't kind enough to tell you when they're lying. Decisions stall in various efforts to check facts and complete due diligence, and people get screwed. But people still need to work together. We need to buy and sell stuff. We need to collaborate and join resources to innovate. So what do you do when you need to work with people but can't trust them? You need a trustless system. You need something that doesn't require trust. Something that assumes that people are lying and still operates effectively, transferring rights without conflict. You need blockchain. Blockchain can be an intimidating topic. It's a field full of people throwing around obscure words and technical theories designed more to keep early adopters feeling like members of a special club than educating people on the technology. But even with the best of intentions, it's a pretty complex topic. It combines philosophy, theories of economic and monetary policy, microeconomic modeling, and a sizable chunk of behavioral psychology. With the crypto bro culture and meme-heavy jargon, it's hard to find a solid foothold to build your knowledge on. Discussions of blockchain and DeFi can make anyone feel like they're back in middle school, afraid to ask questions or even comment. But it's important to remember that blockchain is just a technology. When we think about technology, what is the first thing we think about? Usually some form of hardware, computers, smartphones, weird old switchboards with dozens of wires and women bound to relentless patriarchy. But what is technology really? The best definition is probably one like this. It solves problems people have using scientific knowledge. That's it. It has no real ulterior motive. When you pair a scientific understanding of the world, how things work by principle, not observation, with a specific context, calculate this faster, use fewer people, do work humans can't, extend the ability of humans, etc., you get technology. Cars, sneakers, airplanes, hair dryers, toothbrushes, all types of technology. It feels threatening only when you are in the generation above the generation of mass adoption. At its heart, blockchain is a technological implementation of Yuji Ijiri's seminal accounting innovation, momentum accounting, also known as triple entry bookkeeping. A brief history of accounting. I hear you thinking, wait, what? I thought we were talking about blockchain. I would never buy a book on accounting. Ever. Before you start hunting for the receipt, and stop doing that. I know. I agree. Accounting can be incredibly boring, except that it inspired the greatest of all innovations, writing. Ancient Sumerian tablets, containing some of the oldest writing, are actually simple receipts. I gave you this for that. Merchants tallied their accounts at the end of the day to derive a view of cash flow. And when you think about it, it makes sense. I mean, what's the thing you want to keep track of the most, aside from your kids or pets? Your money. Turns out we've been trying to track value, money we have, debts we're owed, debts we owe, since humans started to understand what my stuff meant. Let's examine what we've come up with over the millennia, starting with single-entry bookkeeping. Single-entry bookkeeping. IOUs are the oldest form of accounting, known as single-entry bookkeeping. This allowed people to begin to trade without having to carry items with them. An IOU in some form is an incredible innovation. Farmers, for example, had few options before this. Either wait at the farm and hope buyers stop by, limited market opportunity, or cart around giant bales of harvested grain to a marketplace to access more and higher volume buyers, high cost of opportunity. Being able to access marketplaces without dragging around bales of grain provided much greater opportunity for sale. In addition, marketplaces could be attended off-season, so farmers could buy things all year, not just for the short period in the fall when grain was harvested and ready for sale. This opened up the world of off-season purchasing with an early form of credit. All this resulted in extra income, which could be used to improve farm efficiency, hire more labor, and improve the ability to support more children. More children meant more money, either by providing free labor to the farm or becoming employees to outside entities, bringing in salaries. In addition, the more frequent market exposure allowed more opportunity for culture and knowledge exchange, which is the basis for human innovation. Payment in advance, whether by seasons or days, allowed people to buy things before they actually had the money. In effect, the IOUs were the first credit cards, physical proof that the debt existed and could be collected. This is the core of provable transfer of resources and how humans were able to expand to nearly every inch of habitable land on Earth. The ability to keep records and learn vicariously is the foundation for all technology and all human knowledge. However, as transactions spread beyond the people in one's town or village, the limitations of single-entry bookkeeping began to reveal themselves. A simple receipt didn't show that anything was received in exchange, nor did it protect against fraud or theft. In addition, businesses had become large ventures. People started to realize that when expenses are investments, they should look different from expenses that are simply repeat expenses of consumable goods. For example, $10,000 spent on pencils should look different to a company's financial picture than $10,000 spent on equipment to manufacture the product sold. And both are different from $10,000 as a one-time payment to set up an overseas subsidiary. We needed a better system to keep up. Enter double-entry bookkeeping. Double-entry bookkeeping. In the 11th century, bankers of the medieval Middle East created double-entry bookkeeping, likely culled from a version of the Indian Jamanama system. This was revolutionary because it required both parties to enter both sides of a transaction, assuring greater accuracy and reliability, as well as account for expenses and revenue as they actually impacted the total company, rather than simple cash flow. This is the move from recording, "I owe you one bale of grain," to, "You gave me three goats, so I owe you one bale of grain." Now parties could trade not just existing goods, but future goods, with a way to account for goods and services owed and paid. Transactions could be carried forward and still remain in each day's records, so that revenue and debt accrued but not paid could still be kept current. This took off in the 1300s with the Genoese Empire, and by the 1600s, it had become the common method of record keeping among the major trading empires. Massive movements of goods, services, and capital across borders resulted, in large part, because the method of accounting for these flows between strangers did not require trust, only proper records and proper receipt. This was the true beginning of globalization. Then, we kind of got stuck. Remember, there were tens of thousands of years between the first humans hanging out by the magic fire and the creation of single-entry bookkeeping, and a few more millennia to the leap to double-entry bookkeeping. Accounting isn't exactly a field that drives innovation. When something works, we tend to keep to the status quo until that status quo simply doesn't work any longer. Massive fraud, or the status quo officially doesn't work any longer. But then, in 1997, the Asian banking crisis happened. What were previously considered stalwart banks making conservative investment and capital management decisions turned out to be an intertwined mess of favoritism and personal enrichment at the expense of shareholders and deposit holders. This was later termed crony capitalism. Expensive, short-term capital and development funds went to inside parties and/or inefficient, poorly managed companies, rather than to those offering the best or most profitable business propositions. Quickly on its heels came the accounting scandals of the 2000s, Enron, WorldCom, HealthSouth, Tyco, AIG. The early 2000s are a ghostly graveyard of blue-chip companies that were cheating shareholders with creative accounting techniques, often backed by the most widely respected independent accounting companies in the world. Respected Big Six accounting firms like Arthur Andersen and KPMG were suddenly connected to shady inside business practices. As the world stared into a gaping hole where millions in revenue should have been, a flaw of the double-entry system was brutally exposed. With the double-entry system, everything is accounted for in arrear, and anything can change or be changed from the moment of entry up until the accounts are audited by an impartial third party. Unaudited accounts were subject to any sort of editing with any sort of rationale, by accident or intention, which did nothing to help people making current and future decisions based on those entries. People started to realize that the mere act of keeping books wasn't sufficient. Third-party editing was mandatory to maintain any sense of reliability or trust. How accounting can be like building an IKEA table, in a bad way. Accounting in arrear means that your records reflect events that happened in the past, not current or future events. For example, say you're a landlord. You get paid on the first of every month, but you do your books on the last day of each month. At the end of the month, you sort through the cash you've received and the expenses you've paid, and you try to match them up. Sometimes, if sometimes means a lot, you don't have an exact match. You end up with something I think of as the bookkeeping version of extra parts when you get something from IKEA. You think you're done building, but then you see these handful of screws and bolts and think, crap, did I need those? You can keep them or toss them, but when those leftover screws and bolts represent actual cash, you don't usually feel like just tossing that in the trash, and doing so might be illegal. You have to figure out where to put these extra bits of revenue or expense, calling it something like extra rent or fixture purchase, to account for it. It might not seem like a big deal, but these bits add up quickly and can result in major crimes like tax fraud or debt default. You can tell how the opportunity and temptation for accidental or intentional fraud is both very high and very easy. A number of companies figured this out, too. It did not end well. Thanks, Enron. Triple entry bookkeeping. In 1988, Dr. Yuji Ijiri, professor at Carnegie Mellon University and president of the American Accounting Association, wrote a monograph discussing a new accounting revolution, momentum accounting, or triple entry bookkeeping. This was less of a sea change in the accounting and business communities than you might expect, more like a puddle change. This was likely because almost no one read it. Momentum accounting is a method of accounting that helps forecasting. It tells you how fast or slow a company is growing. But it required something double-entry bookkeeping doesn't have: facts. As you discovered earlier, double-entry bookkeeping provides a reason for a debit, money you owe, or credit, money someone else owes you. As Dr. Ejidi describes, accounting moved from single-entry bookkeeping, which just records what happened, to double-entry, where what happened has to be explained by reasoning by another account. If you don't have an explanation, you can't have an entry. But it still leaves open the risk of mistake or fraud. If you want to be able to use bookkeeping for prediction, you need something solid to base your prediction on, not guesses or something that may be misremembered or, worse, something both parties colluded on. Something that can't be altered or edited or revised creatively. And from this, we get the idea of a permanent ledger that records in real time, a system in which both parties keep a record of the transaction, but so does the system itself. Do you see the sea change here? Triple entry bookkeeping moves to the logical third dimension of accounting, which is not just a record and a reason, but also an auditable trail. Many have discounted the impact of this methodology, or the relationship of triple entry bookkeeping, to blockchain. However, this revolution is the heart of the functionality of blockchain. But one person did read the monograph, eventually, and it turns out that one person recognized the genius of this innovation. On June 26, 2005, Ian Grigg, a financial cryptographer and later member of the Satoshi Nakamoto Institute, posted this. It was widely recognized, since David Chaum's designs first appeared, that the new digital certificate model of money was not aligned or symmetrical with accounting techniques, such as double-entry bookkeeping. Many people expected the two to compete, and indeed many money systems avoided combining them. This is, I believe, one of the few efforts to integrate the two and show them as better in combination than apart. Note: arrear versus arrears. In arrear means after the fact. For example, payment after the service has been rendered. This is like hiring a cleaning service to clean for the month of August and the company bills you on August 31st. You are paying in arrear. In arrears means behind. For example, payment that is late. If you hired that cleaning service for August and payment is due August 31st, but you don't pay until October 1st, your payment was made in arrears. Triple entry accounting. The digitally signed receipt, an innovation from financial cryptography, presents a challenge to classical double entry bookkeeping. Rather than compete, the two melded together form a stronger system. Expanding the usage of accounting into the wider domain of digital cash gives three local entries for each of three roles, the result of which we call triple entry accounting. This system creates bulletproof accounting systems for aggressive uses and users. It not only lowers costs by delivering reliable and supported accounting, it makes much stronger governance possible in a way that positively impacts on the future needs of corporate and public accounting. This is the core thesis of what later became blockchain technology. As digital cash was maturing through online banking, ATM machines, etc., Grigg noticed the failure of double-entry bookkeeping to account for potential fraud and mistakes in the system. More importantly, however, he created a solution. By pairing the digital certificate of digital cash with a triple accounting system, capital movement could be more reliable and secure and less subject to fraud. Eventually, this method of record keeping wasn't just about recording financial transactions.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?